Welcome to the teaching ministry of Grace Fellowship Church in Bradenton, Florida. We welcome you to join our pastor, William Rogers, as he continues his verse-by-verse study in the Word of God.
Okay, this last section of chapter 3 is, I think it's obvious we see Solomon, he's probably very much alone. And we see, it's almost like he steps back from the scene of the busyness, and we begin to see his thoughts and the pain that I think he's experiencing. He's been very active in all the pursuits or the projects. We know that from chapter 2. He's engaged the help of many other people, and it's as though he's been around a lot of people. And so now he has stepped back out of the scene. And in this section, he kind of pulls aside his thoughts and his musings, if you will. And he observes and meditates and evaluates once again. And one of the questions that seems to surface a lot, especially since the last 2 weeks, is Solomon a saved individual? Is he a believer of the Lord God? Is he a believer of Jehovah? Would he be considered a godly king? And I've had several people ask me what I honestly think, and I think every time I tell you what I think, it's honest.
It should be.
But I'm gonna hold my observations till the end. But I'm starting to see some things about him that have been very interesting for me as I look at his conclusions or his disillusionment. His thoughts, his meditations. And as we get into this, I want to remind you of just a few things. The theme of Ecclesiastes is the fact that he is very cynical and pessimistic. And that is his point of view. That's his point of reference. Everything is from that perspective. Now, the one thing that confuses us, I think, as we begin to analyze Solomon is the fact that God gave him wisdom. But what I want you to think about tonight is, what did he actually give Solomon? If it's a wisdom, was it the wisdom that only comes from above? Or was it the wisdom that comes from man, that comes from humanism? And that is a thought that I want you to think about as you kind of get into this chapter and the next chapter. Because there's two kinds of wisdom. Have you ever thought about the kinds of wisdom that the most wise person in the flesh would have compared to the wisest of God's servants that they would have? If you were to put them side by side, what would be one of the differences in their two opinions? Or their philosophies, or their meditations, or thoughts? Yeah.
The main focus of the humanist would be themselves, and the main focus of the believer in Christ would be God.
Okay. And so I think we see from what she said, we're seeing the perspective from Solomon being very wise and very humanistic from the perspective of man. But every once in a while he will turn and give us something that is a perspective from God, and it's almost like it's a striking contrast between where he's been and where he is at that present point. So Ecclesiastes is built around the thought that everything is empty under the sun. Remember, that's one of his favorite passages or phrases, under the sun, meaning this side of heaven. And so when he says nothing here in itself has meaning, purpose, or definition, he means under the sun. He does not mean from the perspective of a God perspective. He's strictly looking at a very humanistic point of view. The perspective that Solomon's observations are centered around are cynical and pessimistic. Now, what does that mean? What do we mean by cynical or pessimistic? If I were to use the word negative, would you understand that word? very negative. Have you ever been around anyone like that? That their point of view is very negative? Are all y'all thinking of the same person? Surely you're not.
We're not mentioning any names. No names.
No names, okay. But throughout the book, human counsel or human problems or human strength or human struggles are exactly what he's able to observe. He cannot observe the perspective from God because there's no one else there. He can't see that. He can't evaluate that. So Solomon's perspective was from the standpoint of me looking across or horizontal and not upward. And that's a hard thing to see when you look at Solomon, because you tend to think he's the wisest man in the world and he got his wisdom from God, right? And it makes it difficult to see that. But what if he did not get the godly perspective? What if he did not get a godly wisdom from above? What if God just made him extremely wise according to humanism? Is that possible?
Of course.
And so when we look at this, I want you to understand this is the framework of the book. This is the vantage point. All the observations he makes and conclusions he draws are primarily humanistic. Now, when I say humanistic, what do I mean? If I want to take a stab at humanism, it's the human perspective. It's a human perspective apart from God. That's what all his conclusions that he draws upon are primarily humanistic. There are a few glimpses through here. We've seen one or two. We're going to see some more, especially when we get toward the end. But from this point of view, there are very few divine viewpoint or divine perspective. For the most part, his writings reflect human wisdom, and from his perspective, he saw only hardships and injustice. That kind of sets the stage in what we're going to see in verses 16 to 22. And I think you can see this because in 16 through 22, it's as though this wise man takes a break from all his labor and he's evaluating things. It's as though he's pulled back and yet he's actually looking at his works or the observations that he's had and he's reflecting on them. That's basically what he's doing. He's very reflective as an individual. And so we see that one of the problems he has is that he is alone. Look at verse 16. Furthermore, I have seen, he alone has seen. Look at verse 17. I said to myself. Look at verse 18. I said to myself. And we begin to see that he is all by himself with his thoughts and his perspective. Yeah, Oda.
I get the idea that maybe he was depressed.
Well, you do sense a little depression. Okay. And it comes out in a lot of places. And he very well could be depressed because, well, what makes you think he's, what do you see?
Oh, just because he sees wickedness and everything's under the sun is folly. And if you feel that way, you're sort of into yourself and you could be depressed.
Well, you might be. Yeah, and I see depression in some places. I really haven't seen much depression in this point, but I think it is possibly there. If you felt that way, like he feels, you're saying you would feel depressed.
I think so.
But that's because you're thinking from a Godward perspective. If you're not thinking with a Godward perspective and you're thinking humanism, you might not be depressed. You're just simply evaluating the worthlessness of all that is out there. Remember now, we're talking about a king. We're talking about someone who has the wealth and the possibilities are endless before him. We're not talking about someone who has heard about a king who does certain things. He grew up in a king's house. And so he is the son of a king, but now he is king. And he has privileges and perspective like no one else would have. In fact, the things that he is going through is changing Israel constantly. But yet it's also changing the landscape behind Israel. Because of his disobedience, God is raising up out there beyond the horizon, at the moment, horizon. He's raising up enemies. And they're going to come upon the scene very quickly just before his death. We looked at some of that last week. And so from the perspective of Solomon, we see specific comments in verses 16 and 22. The first one I want you to notice is a problem. Look at verse 16. Solomon saw that in places where there should be justice and righteousness, there was wickedness. Things did not often work out fairly. And so you would say he's beginning to evaluate the situation with the people and with righteousness and justice, kind of like what Habakkuk did. You remember what Habakkuk saw? And by the way, Habakkuk, some people have compared Habakkuk and Solomon together. But Solomon comes many years before Habakkuk. Who is that? If that's for me, I'm busy. In many, many times, injustice reigns. We see it today, don't we? If you watch television today, just this very day, you saw it. But we see it all around us. And it's really an amazing thing. Habakkuk saw it and drove him straight to the Lord in prayer by asking God to do something. Fix this. Make it fair for everyone. And so because in the place of justice there was wickedness, there is a sense in most of us that wants things to be right. We look at this and we can almost say with him, you're right. Things are not fair. Things need to be fair. But justice and wickedness is always going to be there, and it's never going to be right like we would want it to be. For example, what did Habakkuk see in the nation of Israel that made him say justice was perverted? You remember what he saw? What is it that would cause a person to see the injustice of either people or the government or society in general or a culture? What is it that causes a person to see that?
Unfairness.
Huh?
Unfairness.
Okay, what causes them to see it is the fact that it's obviously there. Like, is there any unfairness in our society? Uh-huh. Is there any injustice in our society? Mm-hmm. Like what? Just so we know what we're talking about. Like, what would you say is there?
A government.
Are the laws fair?
Not all of them.
The laws are fair, but...
One of the things we have in our neighborhood is we have people that are outright spoken violent against the neighborhood community rules. And so I've been asked many times to, first of all, run for president in the neighborhood. Now, of course, I turn it down often. Or, what do I think about all the rules? And here's what I told the guy just today. The rules are fine until it affects you. If they don't affect you, and the guy said, what's that supposed to mean? I said, well, it's just simply. If they have a rule that says you must keep your garage door closed and mine's always open, then that's offensive to me. Or if it says you must pick up after your dog even in your own yard. Well, if I don't have a dog, I'm fine with that law. Yes, I can do them. But if it says I can't have any yard art in my yard, and anything that is a statue or a sign or anything can be considered art,
that's ridiculous.
Then that affects me. And we can say, well, that's ridiculous because this is not ridiculous trash. This looks good. And your neighbor might think, well, his looks good. We have also a law in our neighborhood that says you can't stamp or color your driveways. Well, you think, well, wait a minute. Why not? Why can't I use white? White's pretty. Well, that's fine. But what if your neighbor likes red, white, blue, green, and yellow? Is that fine? Do you want your neighbor's driveway with multicolored? In fact, my neighbor is the kind of neighbor that would actually do that. He's Hispanic. He loves color. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't put every color under the rainbow in his driveway, just color. Would that be okay?
Not according to the rules, it wouldn't.
According to the rules, it wouldn't. So white is not acceptable. So we tend to think that things are not fair if they affect us. If we are constantly breaking a rule that says you must keep your yard clean, or you must keep your yard cut and trimmed. If you never keep your yard cut and trimmed, what are you going to think about that law? Well, it's not fair. I ought to be able to cut my grass anytime I want to. Brian is dealing with this in his. He has a street. They have a neighborhood that just one street. It's got all new 12 houses on it, and Brian is one of the houses. And so they have the city gave them a list of ordinances that are people that are by. And Brian, one of Brian's neighbors has mops hanging over a thing right outside the door. He's got garbage cans outside. He's got all things. And the covenants say you must put your garbage cans in the garage and no parking on the street. Well, guess what? It's my house. I can keep my garbage cans anywhere I want to, and I can park in the street. Mm-hmm. So he got a ticket parking in the street by the city. But nobody can do anything about his garbage cans out. Now, is it wrong? Is it his house? Can he do anything he wants to with his garbage cans? Well, one of the neighbors is the president of that and told him, no, you can't, because the neighborhood rules say no. He said, well, the neighborhood rules aren't fair. They're not fair because I'm the only one that it affects. And the guy said, no, it's not. It's the only one. You're the only one that breaks it. Everybody else abides by it. If there was no rule, everybody could just have their cans everywhere. And he said, well, how come it's focusing on me? And the guy had to tell him. He said, because you are the one breaking the law. You have to keep the law. So the other neighbor leaves his cans out on the street, puts the garbage out, and he doesn't bring his cans back around. They pick it up every Friday. He doesn't bring his cans back around until probably Sunday, sometimes Monday. Is that right? Is that fair? It's his house. It's his driveway. His cans. Y'all have these problems in your neighborhood?
Yes, we do. Yeah. We're back here laughing.
Yeah, we're just like this.
And so Brian said, Dad, why can't they all just abide by the rule? I said, because in their mind, the rules aren't fair. And that's just what we're seeing here. It's not fair. I love the rule that says you have to pick up after your own dog.
I do too.
Because when I go walking, guess what I see out there in the place?
I did today.
But for me, it doesn't bother me because I don't have a dog. But other people, man, they are ready to just almost like burn the neighborhood down because it affects them and they're the ones not picking up after their dog. You see how this works? It's the same thing that we're talking about right here. Someone is offended by one thing, somebody else doesn't bother them, they can keep it. And so this is what Solomon is saying. Look at verse 17 through 21. Look at 17. I said to myself, this is obviously him bringing out his thoughts or speaking to yourself. Y'all ever talk to yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, they say it's bad when you answer yourself. But here's what he says to himself. God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time, for every matter, and for every deed that is there. Now, what's he saying here? Actually, what he is saying here is that this would be the solution to the problem. The problem is everything is unfair, everything is unjust because of unrighteousness and wickedness in the world. And his solution, in talking with himself, he comes up with two varieties of solutions. The first one concerns God, and the second one concerns man. The first one concerning God is verse 17. I don't need to worry about the unjust out there. I don't need to worry about the things that are not fair out there. I don't need to worry about the wickedness out there. Solomon displayed almost like one of these brief flashes, I like to call of insight, as he looks at this. There is a sense of hope here. He declared that in some yet unrevealed manner, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. There will come a time when all things done under heaven will be brought before God to be judged. So what would be the conclusion in saying that? If that's true, and verse 17 is true, God will judge everything, then what should my response be to them? I think it's obvious. Our response is...
Be a righteous man.
Huh?
Be a righteous man.
Or don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. Okay.
Don't worry about that. Look at the concerning humanity. Look at verse 18 through 21. After giving God's judgment, he says in verse 18, I said to myself concerning the sons of man, or you can say, I said to myself concerning a humanistic perspective, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. In other words, he is saying that really from the evaluation of the human mind, from the human perspective, there's really only a few things. Look at verse 19. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. What in the heck is he talking about?
They all die.
And by the way, when he speaks like this, this has nothing to do with eternal destiny or judgment. It's just pure physical death that he's talking here. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. And from the human perspective, he's absolutely correct, isn't he? Solomon's cynicism is seen, and yet he is speaking from the perspective of the wisest of the human perspective by saying this. Sick of injustice, he's sick of all that he sees. He concludes that man is no better off than the beast of the field. Both man and beast have the same end, which is back to dust.
Right.
From dust you have come, to dust you shall return. Solomon's pessimism discounted even the fact that man has within him a soul. Now, does Solomon understand the difference between man and beast? I think he does. But I think he's saying from the human perspective, man and beast both have the same end. So in the conclusion, which is verse 22 of chapter 3, he says this, and I have seen that nothing is better, that man should be happy in his activities, for there is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? So the conclusion that he's given here is he left his own question unanswered in the verse. Instead, he turned to a practical word to wrap up his own thoughts. It's as though he's concluding and he's answering himself by saying that he observed that injustice is inescapable and the purpose is beyond our understanding and control. So the answer then is Solomon gives good advice to the statement, for whatever our lot in life is, we should strive to make the best of it. And that's from the human perspective. In other words, whatever hand, this is the way some people would say it, whatever hand you've been dealt, live it to the best you can live it.
It's almost like he's not giving anybody any other options. They're going to be thinking this way. It's going to be really distressing. It's going to be, there's no end to it. Your life is like, it'll die, you'll go back to dust. That's it. There's nothing eternal about this at all.
That's right, and there is not.
Almost like he doesn't have that eternal aspect because he is putting himself right into this whole picture.
Yeah, and you think, well, how can somebody be so wise in human philosophy and human perspective? How can they get so wise in that and miss the main point? It's easy, isn't it?
Professor of college.
Yeah. Professing themselves to be wise,
they become fools.
And I used to love Josh McDowell when I was with him, Because he used to say they ought to put that over every college. every university in the country ought to have on them their doors getting in. Professing themselves to be wise, they become fools. So this is the vanity of vanities that he's talking about. And we can begin to understand, I think, that his perspective is one that is not a godly wisdom. I really don't think that is what he's got. Now, he may have had it in the beginning, but the more you begin to see this, like look at chapter 4, verse 1. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which are being done under the sun. What are the acts of oppression he's seeing? He doesn't tell us. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they have no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. And so what he is looking at here, he's looking at a realistic view. Really, this would be, as I see this, I would see the perspective of a leader looking out over all the people. And I see this with him. He is the king. He is over the nation. And I see him looking out, and this is his evaluation of the leadership and all that he sees with the people. That there is an action, there is an oppressiveness with the people. And he says in verses 1 through 3, again Solomon kept his sights, I think, on a human perspective. And he sees this. So look at verse 2. So I congratulated the dead. Now think about this. I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But here's what he does. Look at verse 3. But better off than both of them, the dead and the living, is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity which is done under the sun. Well, let me ask you, from a human perspective, is he right or is he wrong? Is your estimation of what he's saying correct? In other words, his first observation dealt with the oppression of the people. And he did not identify the oppressed people as such, but described their oppressors as powerful. So these are the leaders. These are the ones who have power over people, and they are oppressing the people.
But they report to Solomon.
They report to Solomon. But he's seeing this as a king. He's seeing this from a perspective. And whether he sees this as his rule or whether he sees this is the way it's always going to be with a king or a leadership over people, we don't know. He saw a few powerful individuals, probably very wealthy, who had high positions, who used their position to their advantage. And we know that's true. It's even true today. And so there is a group out there who, at the expense of others, are promoting themselves. They have a power over people. Brian is constantly talking to us about the corporate world out there and how they work. And let me tell you, the corporate world out there is a dangerous place to be. Earl knows. And Brian sees it firsthand. The cutthroat, the stab you in the back, the jealousy, the fight for power is out there. He said, Dad, there's not a single day I don't have people literally coming at me from all angles who want my job, who want to destroy me in the work that I'm doing. It's out there. It's constant. It's a real pressure. And so here, Solomon recognizes that. And so he is evaluating the oppression, the leadership, the advantage taken, and he stated that those who are dead are better off than those who are alive. Is that the assessment we come to? Is it better to say, well, the people who have never been born are better off because they don't have to see what I see? Or is it those who have died? I've heard many Christians say, it's a good thing I don't have children, or it's a good thing my children are grown up, because the way the world is getting, it's better off that I didn't have children to see this. It's the same kind of reasoning. that we have.
Job said that.
Who?
Job said
Job,
that.
Well, Job did say this. And so what is our conclusion to this? We see it. Do you not see oppression of the people? Do you not see the power taking advantage of people? Do you not see the leadership in our country? And it's not just with the president. We're talking about there's all levels of leadership. Even as low as far as the city government or the councils or your neighborhood or your covenants where you live. Man, it's all, we all have to live and see this. So is the conclusion right? Again, he sees three different categories here. This is only the first one. The first category has been, of these three, is that you're better off never to have been born than to see the oppression and the pain and the tears. The second one is in verses 4 through 6 of chapter 4. Look at this. And I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. Well, this would be a burnout situation. And he's moving from the leadership of multiple people down to just two people, a man and his neighbor. And he's not talking about the physical relationship between this person in house A and the person in house B. He's talking about two businesses, two leadership groups coming together, and he's comparing it to two neighbors. And he's saying that Solomon noticed that the competition between man to man to man, or as we would say, from business to business to business, is a very competitive. So his observations do not refer to the healthy competition between businesses or the healthy competition between people, say, even in a sports arena. But he's talking about rather an unhealthy situation that people are in. Fighting and crawling and are craving or just trying to tear one another apart. And this is one thing that Brian shares with us, and I don't know whether you saw it, Earl, in the corporate world, but the fighting that goes on and the politically correct rules that are out there. Do you know that Brian he's the boss in his building. He's over 200 people, and he cannot even have a party. If Brian wanted to have a party at his house for the corporation, he can't have it at his house. They're not allowed to do that. Brian being the boss, it comes across as pressure. It comes across as manipulation. Or Brian said there's about 15 or 20 words they use in describing the reasons he can't. And then it says liability, because if someone is there and Brian doesn't even serve alcohol, but they find alcohol in his closet and they drink it, leave and have a wreck right outside, Brian's liable. Yep. And yet more liable would be the company. Mm-hmm. And so to rule that out, Brian is not allowed to have parties or celebrations at his house. That's interesting. And he also has to watch what he says to people. He can't address people. Well, the rules have just become unbelievable. Brian has right next door to him in his situation, he has an HR department that monitors the office. That's what their full-time job is. They monitor ethics. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
When I was in my business, I was dealing with clients all over the country, all over the world. And one of the things that was so apparent in the last few years was the freeze that was being put on the management, the middle management, to be able to not make decisions because they were afraid that what they were making a decision would not be against the boss's will. And as opposed to making those decisions, they just stopped making decisions and they let their lower management do the same thing. And that's why you have a lot of production problems in this country. Yeah. Because these people are afraid of making decisions.
Yeah.
They're trying to cover their own,
Well, Brian is so afraid of it, he doesn't even want to have friends. in the company. Mm-hmm. It's like, just scratch it off, there's no possibility. Somebody mentioned one day Brian possibly dating this girl that liked him or something there. And he said, there's no way on this planet I can date somebody in the office. Because it's gotten so competitive there. If somebody sees something that Brian is doing out of line, they will attack him on it because they want him brought down. Because he's the boss. And so it's really an incredible thing. But Solomon here is seeing the role here of competitiveness and the fact that we in competitive situations get caught up in it. We instinctively want to be recognized, or we want to win, or we want to be on the right side. And so this is what Solomon is talking about. This special group rightfully endorses a balance between these two positions. People who get caught up in the competition and they strive to fight one another, or they get so far away from it. Life moves fast and we must get actually on board with it. And so I think Solomon is recognizing this as the competitiveness with what he sees. And look at what he says in verse 6. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. What's he saying?
Idle.
Okay, it was what?
Idleness.
Okay, idleness, okay, compared to the fighting and the competition,
effort,
driving you so far out that mm-hmm. your whole perspective is actually just chasing after the wind. But it's the third one, verse 7 and 8, I think is the focus. In verse 7 and 8, he sees another disillusionment of this, and look at what he says. Then I looked again at vanity under the sun, as though he backs up and looks again at the broad picture of humanity. There was a certain man without a dependent. What does that mean? What is without a dependent?
Someone he takes care of. Yeah.
Without a dependent, it's a tax term, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. I want you to catch what this individual is doing. So far, who is this kind of an individual?
A single guy doing what?
Workaholic.
I've got Brown written in my margin.
mm-hmm.
Look at what it says. Yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied. That's not my son, but that is this individual. Which means what? His eyes are not satisfied. What?
He kept driving and driving and striving for more.
Huh?
Greedy. Can't get enough.
He can't get enough
right.
with the riches, and he never asks, and for with whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? So in other words, why am I doing all of this? I have no heir. I have no dependent in my home. I don't even have a brother that I'm working for. He says, this too is vanity and is a grievous task. So from this person that we see in verse 7 and 8, how would you advise that person?
Wow.
Get more rest.
Well, it's not just rest. It is what are you working so hard for? Yeah.
Buy a new car and go all over the lower 48.
Yeah.
Through your
program. Yeah, travel. Slow down. No, Moses.
This is one of his observations, this kind of individual. This is what Solomon sees. The first dealt with the masses of people. The second one is more of oppression between two kinds of people, or two neighbors, or two local businesses. And then this man works, has more money than he can ever spend, which would probably be a lot concerning this day, yet he continues to extremely grow it. And that's the implication, is he's growing it and growing it and growing it. This man is alone. He has no family. There's no mention of friends. At this point, Solomon asks a question which few people ask. Why am I doing all of this?
Never satisfied.
For who is it? Does that remind you of anything in the New Testament? Any parable in the New Testament that you might think of?
something like that. What if we take the whole world and lose our own soul?
That's it. Let's turn to it. Luke chapter 12. I knew Paul would be my hero. Luke chapter 12. It's really an amazing parallel here that we see. What is the advantage to me working this hard, making this kind of money, storing up for myself all of this, only to die and leave it to no one? It'd be something, wouldn't it? Of course, if you die, you're not going to worry about who got it. But look at chapter 12 of Luke, verse 13 through 21. Mike, you want to read verses 13 to 21?
And someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to them, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a certain rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' And he said, 'This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, "Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now, who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God."
You know, it's a very interesting parable. What do you think Christ is trying to teach this particular... See, this is a crowd he's speaking to. And this is a question that comes up from the crowd. Look at verse 15. "And he said to them, 'Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed.'" You see that? Mm-hmm. "For not even when one has abundance does his life consist of his possessions." What is he saying there? What is that text actually giving us? Yeah.
That everything comes from God.
Okay, everything comes from God. So all this wealth that this godless person is building up is a warning that Jesus is speaking against. He's speaking against, "Be on your guard against every form of greed." Now, if you were to be able to see greed in people as a color, say blue. I'm not going to say green. I refuse to use green. All right, we'll use green. If you could see greed, what would we see in our world around us? I think we'd see that's all we would see.
That's right.
I mean, how much of injustice and perversion, a travesty of justice, it's because of greed. How much is out there? How much of what is taking place in Washington this very day is because of greed? It is absolutely incredible that we see these kinds of things, that even though your life consists of possessions, they're not really yours. And you've heard it before, not anyone has ever had a U-Haul following the hearse.
No pockets on a shroud.
You can't take anything with you, can you? Not a thing. And so, Christ's story centered around a successful farmer. It applies to every single person in this world. Absolutely incredible. The man wondered what to do about his growing fortune, but he never asked himself, where does God fit into the picture? Why do you think that question doesn't come up more often? Where was God in any of the... in anything? I mean, we could ask that question about so many things. Where is God? Where is God? Where is God? And God's not there, is He?
Not in
the people.
Not in the people, though.
the analogy. God has given us the ability. In fact, doesn't this sound like Solomon when you read this? He says here, "But God said to him, 'You fool,' but after he had said, 'I will say to my soul, this day, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" So maybe he's saying this ought to be security. How many of y'all believe in a security for your own well-being? And in that security, you must have insurance and money. I mean, don't we think that today?
Sure. And a house.
And it has to be. I mean, that's not a wrong thought, is it? Okay. Is it wrong to say I'm worried about the security of my family and the well-being of my family, that they'd be taken care of? And so there's insurances. There's all kinds of things that we worry about, getting things ready for that. And that's all good, isn't it? But there's also the security that is eternal security that we don't worry about. I don't think many people at all worry about the eternal destiny. I heard last night on a show, I turned on the TV just for a little while to get off of the news, which I do frequently when Carol's not there, because I can't get off of the news when she's there. So I heard this on the show. I don't even know what I was watching. But the guy said, "Look, don't you understand that when people die, they all go to heaven?" I'm thinking, wait, what is this? It was a Hallmark movie.
Stairway to Heaven?
No, it wasn't Stairway to Heaven. But what is wrong with that philosophy? And doesn't the world believe that?
Yeah.
If you were to go in there and interview these people, what few are out there? I don't even know if there's anybody out there.
There's quite a few.
Doesn't everybody think they're going to heaven?
Sure.
They sure do.
Every TV show, every person.
Yep.
There's a movie star that just died that had a Hallmark movie out. And they did a special on him the other day. I can't. It's Luke somebody.
Oh, Perry.
Who?
Luke Perry.
Yeah, Luke Perry.
Luke Perry.
I think he played one Hallmark movie. But he came from another.
902.
Okay, I never saw that. That's why I didn't know what that was. And they were talking about him, and they were talking about how at peace and rest he is, that he is in heaven. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know Luke Perry. Is that his name?
Yeah.
I don't know him, but I certainly hope he is in heaven."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because how many people would you say, "Well, I know he died. He split hell wide open." You know, or he's in hell with the rest of his friends and they're partying. I have heard that kind of analogy. But you don't hear, you know, of a funeral, and on TV they're saying, "Well, we know he's dead. You know, he's not resting now. He had his best life, and now he's being tormented in hell."
No.
What would you think if you heard a service like that?
Yeah.
Would you do a funeral for a lost person and you knew the best you could say is that their best life has already been lived? Could you do it, Earl? Could you do it, Ed? What would you do?
I'll call you.
I'm busy,
Huh?
I'm busy then. What's the next thing? I'm busy.
But what about the next week? I'll be busy then too. It's just an amazing thing to think that our destiny is so much more important than our security in our homes and our families. And yet more people are worried about the insurance or the security or their family, but they're not worried about the eternal destiny of this. I think it's a practical response for us. They go back to the Ecclesiastes. And I think when he says here, "And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure?" It is really a thought-provoking question. Then he says, this too is vanity, and it is a grievous task. Now, the verses 9 through 16 we're going to take as a whole separate unit because of the way it's pieced together. And I don't want to get into that. But I do want to look at the last phrase, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? What is he asking there? For whom am I depriving myself of pleasure? What's he saying in that one actual statement there?
Why am I doing it?
Okay, but what? Well, who am I depriving myself? What is the myself referring to? Who am I depriving myself of pleasure? What is he actually asking? Because we could ask this question.
What's my reward?
Okay, what's my reward? That might be, but...
Why am I asking so hard?
Okay, why am I working so hard? Or for whom am I actually working this
myself.
Hard?
Myself.
Right?
So.
I mean, do y'all work for other people? Ed, are you working for others?
Yes.
Ed, Earl, are you working for anybody else?
Oh, yeah.
Well, just think, if you don't have anyone, is it saying the opposite here? Is it saying that since I don't have others, not to work? Or what is the? I mean, after all, this is humanism, and this is human perspective. What does human perspective conclude? What is it actually concluding if I say, "For whom am I laboring?" Well, nobody. And depriving myself of pleasure, there is nobody. So this is vanity, and vanity of the wind is chasing after the wind, and it is a grievous task. What is the answer? If there is no one, what would the humanist point of view answer that with?
His self, but he's working for himself.
Okay, he is working for himself. Better That's time. The only person that he's got. He's got no family, no brother, no son, no other family that he mentioned. Doesn't even mention friends.
Right.
So, for whom am I doing this? What's the right answer to give this man, huh?
To the Lord.
Well, but think about it. How do you do that? How do you work for the Lord in my work? Think about it from the humanist perspective. I mean, you can't even really justify the work as far as from the spiritual perspective of today. If you're alone, how are you working and earning all this money? To give it to the Lord? I mean, is that the answer of what he's saying here? Well, he's not saying that. But how do you do what he's actually saying? You see, from the humanist perspective, he has no real answer other than the fact there is no one. So is he saying there should be someone? What about if I just go out and get a wife?
Yeah,
then
yeah.
I've got somebody.
He's got me.
Huh?
He's feeling there's got to be something else.
There's got to be something else.
Yeah.
And what is the something else? Joanne?
Things.
What are you saying about the things? Things is what he's getting.
He may not have been driving a car, but maybe it was a wheelbarrow back then. I don't know.
Okay.
Bringing
yeah.
in horses.
Yeah. Don't lust after your neighbor's wheelbarrow. Yes, sir?
Well, there are quite a few programs that have evaluated all this stuff, and one of the things that the union problem that they have today is that there are people who work very, very hard to do their job, and the people who don't work very, very hard get jealous of the people that are making more money than they are, so they go demand more money because that person's working harder, and so that person sees that these people are making as much money as he is, and all of a sudden it becomes useless for him to work as hard as he was because he's not going to be getting any more than they are, even though they don't work nearly as hard. And so everybody goes home useless. Everything is useless. And it's happening in today's society, in our corporations.
Right, sum up what you just said.
Okay.
I don't know.
People,
I'm not sure I caught it. Did y'all catch it?
There's no satisfaction.
Right.
There's no fulfillment.
Okay.
You can work very hard for a reason. But if someone looks at where you're working and is jealous because you're making more money, even though you're working very hard for a reason, then they can protest with their power of numbers and so forth and make you look like a fool for working as hard as you are, because we're going to get as much money as you are, if we're just going to demand it.
Okay.
So it is a vanity.
Okay, but no, that's not what he's talking about here.
No, but I think that's what is going on in our world.
Well, yeah, that might be going on in the world, but what is he saying here? As far as the... Are you hot?
No.
Okay. I do that when I'm not hot, too.
She was concerned about a wheelbarrow.
Oh, she's still confused on the wheelbarrow.
Yeah, she's got a wheelbarrow.
At least her hand wasn't doing this. Hallelujah!
When I was a single guy, I worked. I didn't really have anybody, and I worked hard because I wanted to provide for myself. I still, you know, of course, this guy didn't have anybody. I had brothers and sisters and family. So that changes the story. But I still had to provide for myself, put food on the table, and pay my bills. If I wanted to drive a vehicle, if I wanted a home, I had to work to get that. So that's what he's doing.
Well, okay, but I want y'all to... I'm trying to...
What are you trying to give me?
I'm trying to turn your thinking. I want you to see the bigger picture here. It's kind of like, go up to 30,000 feet and look down at what Solomon is saying. He's talking about working, sure. He's talking about possessions. He's talking about storing up. We even looked at the parable of Jesus talking about storing up for yourself treasures. So what is it about the heart that wants to store up? What's the bigger picture here of what we're seeing with Solomon and what his humanistic approach is to this, and why there's no answer listed here that we ought to have an answer for?
Green.
You, with the wavy hands.
Well,
I'll take you too.
You talked about last week that he's trying to fill a void in his life with everything there is. Say it, girl. I just see waving back there. The peripheral vision is gone.
I was going to say the same thing. There's a void in his life. He's got that vacuum.
Okay, right? That's right.
He needs...
Right, keep the development going. Keep it going. What do you see there in that? In other words, think more of the answer. Okay, he's doing this. Therefore, he either needs to change this or something else has to happen.
Do it for something.
It is in the heart, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but what is it about the heart?
There's no eternity.
In other words, the accumulation over here in storing has become, this is going to give it away, but I got to say it, it has become his God. It has become his focus. I'm so busy doing this. Who am I doing it for? It's not really the question. The question is, why am I doing it? That might be a question. But what about having time for the Lord? What about having your objective as glorifying God in everything you do? That answers the question, because it's a matter of worship. It's a matter of the heart. We are so deceived by materialism. You know that I believe there are actual literal demons that are over the materialistic world to taunt us with. Because we are so easily swayed by materialism. We're so easily swayed, none of us probably think we're materialistic. And we are filthy rich in materialism. But yet, has our materialism taken us to the place to where that is more important to us than God himself? Is it possible to be that way? That's what the parable's about, is it not? Thou fool, your soul is going to be required of you tonight. Meaning what?
what's going to happen to all the stuff you make?
Yeah, well, who cares about all the stuff? It's not about the stuff. Right. But we always want to make it about the stuff. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's more a matter of our own heart. It's this. This is the problem. And it's always that problem. It's this is the problem if there's greed, right? It's not the greed. It's almost like saying, I'll use this as an example. Guns don't kill people.
They don't.
I mean, I can put my gun in my drawer for 100,000 years and it's not going to jump out of there and shoot somebody. Right?
Right.
But you put it in the pocket or you put it in on the hip of someone else and suddenly that gun was used to kill someone. So where was the problem?
Heart.
Was it in the wrong bullets?
Nope.
No. Was it the fact that the gun got loaded?
No.
It's the heart. We can't see that. Why can't America see that problem? Right there, just that one. Why can't they see it?
Because they don't have the eyes to see it.
They don't
have spiritual eyes.
Yeah. And so, to whom much is given? Us. Much is required, right? We are held accountable for what God has given to us. We ought to be the most concerned about the materialistic grip of our society that has on us. Materialism. I'm not condemning wealth. It's the heart. It's always the heart, Mike.
It was a fellow I read about a few years ago. He was in Denver, I think it was, and he was a multi-millionaire, hundreds and hundreds of millions. He had no relatives. He had no inheritance. He gave it all away because he realized at the end of his life, this was all meaningless. This was all useless. And he had become a Christian later in his life, but he gave it all away so that other people could. And he was really reluctant to do that because the stuff that he had, the material he had, could give them the same idea of, oh, I got to get this, and the greed and the power and so forth. But he gave it all away.
I think a good question we could ask ourselves tonight would be this. How does your relationship to Christ affect the role you have with your own possessions? How does your relationship to Christ? And really, what that's asking is this. How has Christ changed my life? And you have to look. If you're going to ask that honestly, then your life is in categories, so to speak. The physical, whether it be all of these things. And one of the things is going to be possessions. What is my relationship? Or how is my relationship to Him affected by the role that materialism or possessions play in my life? That's a tough one to answer. In a humanistic society, very humanistic world like we are in, so it's okay to work. It's okay to work and earn lots of money. The problem becomes immoral when that is replacing Christ, isn't it? And that's a hard place to be. The most miserable person, they say, on the planet is the Christian living out of God's will, away from it, apart from it, and trying to still satisfy that part of their soul that is already filled, trying to fill it with worldly things. Not that I would ever do that. Let me tell you something. Life is a slippery place to be. You can slip and slide all over the possessions and the greediness around us. Any questions? These discussions, I tell you, I am seeing some rich things about Solomon that I'm going to still say. But it's really an amazing thing to see this. Look at next week. We're going to read 9 through 16. If you get a chance, read those and see what you see. Because it's a very interesting section. And then chapter 5, we get into it, is a section that I include in every wedding ceremony I've ever done. Is in there. Chapter 5. All right, let's have a time of prayer. Mike, you want to lead us in a prayer?
Oh, Father, thank you so much for filling our heart with your love and giving us eternity, giving us a glimpse of eternity, and being able to read and understand to some degree as a human, understand what people like Solomon wrote about in this book and what you have shown us continuously through this man who preaches before us, who gets the word every week by study and by the Holy Spirit leading him, guiding him, so that we can be led and guided in the same way. So we ask you, Lord, to continue to bless him and bless this group. And we thank you for the evening. We ask these things in Jesus' name.
Amen.
You have been listening to the teaching ministry of Grace Fellowship Church in Bradenton, Florida, with Pastor William Rogers. We invite you to join us in worship every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. We are located at the corner of Manatee Avenue East and East 9th Street on the center floor of the Manatee Central Banquet Hall. We pray that you will join us again next Sunday as we continue to teach God's Word one verse at a time.